You're on a GLP-1. Your appetite is changing, your cravings quiet down, and food noise is finally fading. But now you're wondering, how do I manage my side effects? What do I eat to stay strong? How do I break through a plateau? Because reaching your weight loss goals can take more than meds. That's where Weight Watchers Med Plus comes in. The support designed to help you navigate what comes next. With trusted experts who guide you, food plans that work with your body, support to help manage side effects, plus access to GLP-1 medication. Weight Watchers Med Plus is designed to help you lose more weight. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com. All medical services are provided through our affiliated medical group, Weight Watchers Clinic. Medications require eligibility and prescription. Individual results may vary. See site for more details.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. We've got a great show for you this week. Look, usually on this pod, we talk about the intersection of sports and politics. Not today. We are talking, it's about one of the great things about having my own podcast, y'all. We're talking about probably my favorite musical group, not my favorite hip-hop group, my favorite musical group, and that is De La Soul, as in De La Soul is of the soul. Now, why are we talking about De La Soul? Because there is a new book out that I am so into. It's called Living in a Daisy Age, The Music, Culture, and World De La Soul Made. And I've got the author of it right here. His name is Professor Austin McCoy. He's an assistant prof of U.S. and African American history at West Virginia University. In addition to hip-hop culture, Austin McCoy's research also focuses on labor, social movements, and political activism. His writings about politics and culture have appeared in the Washington Post, CNN, The Baffler. So excited to speak to him. Let's take a quick break, listen to a little bit of De La Soul right here, a little bit of a song from their new album. It's called Run It Back. And then we're going to jump right in to the man himself, Austin McCoy. So excited to speak to him.
It's the birth of a team here to clean up the turf, and the worth of the dream is to change the regime and the lean that we lay with the words that we spray with the way that we teach y'all to act.
Run it back
with the pawns, with the dice, and the songs that we slice with the plate.
The book is Living in a Daisy Age, The Music, Culture, and World De La Soul Made. The author is Austin McCoy. Thank you, Professor McCoy, for joining us here on the pod.
Yeah, thanks, Dave, for having me. This is an honor.
Oh man, it's a thrill for me, believe me. It's, you might even say it's De La-cratic.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, as authors, we all have choices, we all have proposals, we all have ideas about what we might want to explore. Why did you go with De La Soul?
Well, De La Soul is one of my, you know, all-time favorite rap groups, you know, alongside of, you know, folks like A Tribe Called Quest, Wu-Tang Clan. And this project found me. So an editor actually reached out to me in the wake of David Delacour's passing because I was, you know, posting about, you know, my feelings about De La Soul on Twitter, right? Back when Twitter was still okay, you know, not the cesspool that it is now. So, yeah, like, you know, she asked if I was interested in writing a book about De La Soul, you know, from a historical perspective. And I was like, absolutely. Right. I mean, like, this would be a dream because I teach about hip hop history in my classes. Obviously, I've been a big fan. You know, I think I started learning about hip hop before I started learning about anything else, you know, as a teenager. So that's how I came to the book. And then, yeah, from there, it was just a matter of, you know, how would I approach it? At first, like, I thought I was going to just write these, you know, very thematic, highfalutin' chapters about, you know, their songs. And then I took a step back and I just thought, well, how would this look as a documentary? That's sort of how I approached it. Like, I mean, I'm no documentarian, but like, I thought, you know, how would this look? Like, what would people who did not know about De La Soul, but then also who were huge fans of De La Soul. How would they, how would both of these groups sort of want to, like, what would they want to see? And that's how I settled on, talking about their first, four albums, in a deep dive, and then basically using the last, third, last few chapters of the book to sort of cover their careers during the 21st century.
Now, before we get more into De La, I have some choice. I have questions about some of the choices you made in writing the book because I've read my share of hip hop books, and there are some real distinctions that I found in living in a Daisy age. One was that you put your own childhood, your own biography, your own upbringing, it squarely right in the middle of it, interwoven throughout. Can you help us understand that decision? And is that something you would have done with any book you did about hip hop at that time? Or is there something particular about De La where you said, my story needs to be a part of this?
I think all of the above, right? I mean, so at first, I was a like you're a journalist, and a lot of folks who write about hip hop culture, especially these biographies, are journalists. And you all operate in your community. And for me, it was okay. I'm writing this book about De La Soul. There's a couple of other journalists who've written about De La Soul as well, and their books are pretty are good. And for me, it was okay. I need to let those who write about hip hop know who I am, right? Because yeah, it's like, who's this guy? Like this book is coming out, and frankly, it's just like, well, who's this guy that is, just appearing, writing this book about De La Soul? He's not a journalist. He's a historian, and obviously, I'm not poo-pooing, people in my field or anything like that. But not a lot of us write about hip hop history, within history, within the history discipline, which is, I think improving, and I think we're going to see more books about hip hop culture. But no, part of it was wanting to establish myself as a fan of De La Soul, a fan of hip hop culture, and then I think those of us who are fans of music never. We never miss an opportunity to at least demonstrate how much we might know, about what we're talking about. So, part of, grounding myself within the story was to, basically establish a little bit of, authority in terms of, like I've been studying this for a long time, in addition to studying, the history of social movements, labor, and activism. So wanting to do that, but then also it just made sense. At the same time, it felt very pragmatic when I sat down to write the proposal for the book, and then when I sat down to sort of write the book, my first thoughts were my personal experiences, whether they were, watching me, myself, and I, at 8 years old, and sort of thinking about my reaction to the video, whether it was teaching, hip hop history, is when I taught it at Auburn, and introducing students to De La Soul and remembering their reactions to PostaNoose, Maceo, and Trugoy, because they had no conception of the group existing, especially due to the fact that their music wasn't on streaming at the time. So yeah, it just made a lot of sense, right, for me to one, okay, I need to let everyone know, especially the folks who write about hip hop full time, that okay, like I, appreciate De La Soul, I appreciate the history of hip hop culture, and I appreciate the culture generally. But then also, yeah, just my own experiences is what I first think of when I think of the group too.
And also the fact that it sounds like you had a high level of identification with both loving hip hop, but maybe not feeling like you stand in the particular, whether you want to call it braggadocio, whether you want to call it CNN of the streets, as Chuck D said, so like you're coming at it not from that angle, the same way De La Soul didn't come at it from that angle. And it's just you feel your identification, like, okay, I love this music independently of De La Soul, but now I actually feel like there's a group that's speaking to me. Is that fair
Definitely.
to say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I I think watching Me, Myself, and I, hearing that song for the first time, that was probably the first time that I can remember going, oh, rap music is that's for me, right? I mean, like the music that my parents listened to, that I grew up, obviously around them listening to, like Earth, Wind, and Fire, Brothers Johnson, Michael Jackson, Janet Jackson, I liked it, but watching Me, Myself, and I was like, wow, that's for me. And then, I also think to myself, being 10 years old and, going to the eye doctor and them saying, you're going to need glasses, and just sort of feeling devastated because, wearing glasses, at such a young age, at least in my circles, was like, oh no, you are definitely a nerd. Right. I mean, so, I think, seeing someone like PastaNoose, rap about his glasses on Me, Myself, and I, and these folks, the group sort of rapping in an intelligent manner, in the sense of, distinguishing themselves from, the Run DMCs and Big Daddy Kanes and some of the other, major artists that were out at the time. And obviously not saying that they weren't intelligent in their own way, they were. But yeah, De La Soul, their image, the way that they spoke on record, definitely appealed to me, as I was, 8, 9, 10, but then also as I, grew up and went into high school.
Let's listen to 20 seconds of Me, Myself, and I right now.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Tell me, mirror, what is wrong? Can it be my daylight clothes or is it just my daylight song?
Yeah, that song for so many of us was our introduction to De La Soul. It reached us. And yet, as you write at great length in the book, they did not like that song. I remember telling saying to you when you were in town about seeing them perform it while they held catcher's gloves in front of their faces so their voices would be muffled. Do you think, I mean, so they didn't like it, as you write, because they felt like it was a commercial add-on and not really and less about their vision. But do you think they appreciate on some level like what it meant to people to get that kind of feeling that it's okay to be an individual in this world of hip hop, which at the time seemed to demand more conformity than individuality?
Yeah, I think no, I mean, that's sort of one of the best stories about the group, right? Is sort of how they come onto the scene, Me, Myself, and I, 3 Feet High and Rising, embracing the Dayglo colors, the funky haircuts, developing their own language, right? And yeah, they turn in the album, Tommy Boy says, we need a single. And it's Maceo and Prince Paul who sort of stumble onto this idea while at a party. They hear a DJ drop the needle on Parliament Funkadelic's Knee Deep, and Maceo's like, this is a song. But Maceo in the Netflix documentary Hip Hop Evolution talks about how PastaNoose and TruGoy basically just they took a big dump on the record in terms of how they approached their delivery. It's very deadpan. The song is very sarcastic. And then over time, as you told us at the event, they basically would, sort of perform the hook saying, we hate this song. Right? I mean, so like they were not shy about how they felt about the track. And yeah, this sort of sets up this tense relationship between them and Tommy Boy, right? As the record label is trying to make money. But I do, it does seem like over time, especially in the last 10 years, they've come back around in terms of expressing their public appreciation for Me, Myself, and I, and for the Daisy Age that 3 Feet High and Rising set off. So when they, when they organize their, basically they're going home event for Dave Jalakor after his passing, like you could sort of see all this, 3 Feet High and Rising iconography, this sort of, throughout the venue that they were performing. I wasn't there, but you could watch it on YouTube. So like, yeah, and there were constant references to Daisies, and yeah, it seems now, right, as they've come to sort of, really take stock on their own, their own legacy, that I think they've come around to embracing it again. But yeah, for a long time, it was, we hate this song.
You talk about how Arsenio Hall, who people forget now, certainly how influential he was in terms of introducing hip hop to a national audience. Arsenio called them the hippies of hip hop, which really pissed them off. And I remember seeing an interview with Dave Chugoy Jolicor when 3 Feet High came out, where he described himself and all of them as, yeah, hip hop nerds is what they called themselves. What's the distinction there, if you can talk about that? Like, what's a hip hop nerd versus a hippie of hip hop, and why would they want to claim one over the other?
So starting with hippie, I mean, many of us who, either some of us, some folks in our generation have parents who might be self-described hippies, right? Folks who were part of the 1960s and 1970s counterculture, and broadly defined, right? Whether it is folks who were sort of the diggers in Berkeley, right? And sort of folks who sort of operated in those communities where it's very communal, nonviolent, sort of embracing psychedelic drugs, free love, right? I mean, like you have all of these sort of elements that go into counterculture, obviously standing in opposition to the to the stale, oppressive, quote unquote, one-dimensional culture of mainstream United States, especially when thinking about it, political liberalism, during the 1960s. So the counterculture was very much in reaction to mainstream politics, mainstream, popular music, et cetera, et cetera. And I think De La Soul's, De La Soul bristled at the term hippie, even though they still wore the peace medallions, right, and sort of looked countercultural, and they presented themselves as countercultural to mainstream rap music. I think they bristled at that term, because of the sort of nonviolent, like there's the nonviolent aspect of, this understanding of being in hippie. I think so, they had folks on tour who were, testing them physically, right? And they, they were getting into fights. I tell, they tell this story, and I like to sort of echo it at events where they're on tour with NWA, LL Cool J, all these other much more quote unquote harder rappers, and they're the ones who get kicked off the tour for fighting, right? So like, this concept of hippie for them, Ray, for people outside of their group, raised sort of questions about, whether or not De La Soul was nonviolent. But then De La Soul is operating within an environment where, yeah, they would have people trying to test them, and they had to defend themselves, right? I mean, so I think that's one aspect. There also seems to be a racial component. So if you listen to the end of Ain't Hip to Be Labeled a Hippie, where there's this, exchange between Pasta Noose and Prince Paul, and Prince Paul is asking them, or saying something about them being hippies, and Pasta Noose denies it, and Pasta Noose sort of says, yeah, we're just soul brothers and sisters. And Prince Paul's like, oh, really? Right? I mean, so like, the sort of soul brothers and sisters reference also sort of harkens back to the 1960s, black nationalism, pro-blackness, black pride, the signs that black shop owners would sort of hang in Watts in Detroit when black folks were taken to the streets, and protesting and rioting against police brutality and structural racism, right? I mean, so like there seems to be, or at least I interpreted it as also we're pro-black, but it's not to say that there weren't black hippies. George Clinton in his autobiography calls himself a hippie, right? And DJ Red Alert called De La Soul, basically the Parliament Funkadelic of hip hop, in the late 80s, right? I mean, so like there's all these connections, but I think sort of parsing through those and sort of think about the term hippie historically is important. And then, yeah, what does it mean to be a hip hop nerd? I think, it means that, you have someone who is, they might have the appearance of the nerd, of a nerd, right? I mean, so like, wearing glasses, especially at the time. They're not, these De La Soul members of Native Tongues, they weren't wearing the big fat gold chains. They weren't wearing the, they weren't wearing quote streetwear. They were sort of embracing the Afrocentric clothing of the 1980s as well. But then also they presented themselves as, sort of, thinking people's lyricists, right? I mean, so like they were very much thinkers, very artistic. And again, coming up with their own language, coming up with their own style of dress, forming, the native tongues, which has, connections to Afrocentricity, right? I mean, so I think, if you want to say counterculture and nerddom sort of coming together at this moment, like I think there's a connection there. But if you're talking about the term hippie, then I think for De La Soul, it sort of carried this other sort of racial, if not historical, baggage.
And we let's talk about the Five Mic classic album, De La Soul Is Dead. Their second album, a rejection, an open rejection, top to bottom of everything people said about them from 3 feet high and rising, whether it's the hippiedom, whether it's the Daisy Age, whether in terms of how that was misinterpreted. And just incredible album. Just this rejection of who people like this platinum selling group, they're saying we are not this. How unheard of that is that in hip hop, like this rejection of who you were to make a different kind of record? And really a broader pop cultural question, like how unheard of that is music in itself? Like I was racking my brain, and other than Dylan going electric, I was having a tough time even thinking of an established artist just saying, hey, whoever you thought we might have been, we are not that any longer. So lose any preconception as to who you thought we were.
I mean, the Departure album, right? I mean, and no, that's one of the reasons why De La Soul Is Dead is one of my favorite, like all-time favorite albums across genre. And it's also one of my, it's my favorite De La Soul album. It's one of my favorite hip hop albums, because I just thought when I, listened to it for the first time in high school, I was just like, exactly, how does one do this? Right? Like, how does one completely just abandon what made them popular, for the sake of, and basically, according to Mace, for the sake of, artistic survival, right? I mean, like, they were like, we don't want to be trapped, within the Daisy. So yeah, in hip hop, and I feel like they're the first rap group, rap artist to really sort of put together this departure in such a stark way, right? I mean, like, just obviously from the album cover, knocking over the Daisy and killing off the Daisy. And the cover is, mostly black and white, right? I mean, so very opposite compared to the bright and colorful 3 Feet High and Rising cover, to, the rapping about fighting, right? I mean, Peace Porridge, Oodles of O's, Afro Connections at a High Five. I mean, like, they are sort of, on the one hand, critiquing hardcore rap, but at the same time, again, saying, we are not the guys that you thought we were on Me, Myself, and I. We still might be making fun of ourselves, but don't get it twisted, right? We also are formidable lyrically, artistically, and also physically, right? I mean, so there's very much a, sort of not just rejection, but complicating, our understandings of black masculinity within hip hop culture in the early 1990s. Yeah, I think De La Soul Is Dead sort of sets the standard for, and sort of opens up the path for, groups like Outkast, right? I mean, to go from Southern Playlist to Cadillac Music to Atliens, right? I mean, like, which
Yeah, great
is,
call, great call.
and not only that, De La Soul Is Dead sort of sets a precedent for the group to sort of, to put out albums at least until the first artificial intelligence that are very different, which is something that Outkast does as well, right? I mean, like, to go from Southern Playlist to Cadillac Music to Atliens to Aquemini to Stankonia, right? I mean, like, so, it's hard to, imagine Outkast's own trajectory without De La Soul laying that foundation in rap that says, yes, you can make a departure album that is so far afield and still be very successful while also retaining your own ethical vision of art artistry.
Their album after that is, to me, one of the most flawless albums ever produced. Flawless. It's probably might be my Desert Island Disc, whatever you want to call it. I'm talking about Balloon Mind State, an utter masterpiece. I was hoping to hear from you as to what makes it so. What makes it so singular in your mind? and maybe say something else if you could about what was happening in hip hop more broadly, about the reclamation of jazz music from what it was being seen as the time, which was really niche music with a white audience. And this effort by hip hop, by artists like Guru to try to reclaim it. Can you speak to that, please? Like what makes Balloon so perfect? And where does jazz fit into this matrix?
Balloon Mind State, admittedly, when I first listened to it, and I think I was probably 17, I liked some songs, but I didn't get it. I didn't understand it, especially coming after De La Soul is Dead. It was okay, what does the title mean? Like, why are they I can understand them talking about not going pop. But yeah, just sonically, I just wasn't there. And then over time, that's one of those albums I've come to appreciate a lot more. Because of bringing in the JB Horns, right? I mean, like, so Pasinous, Dave, Prince Paul, right? I mean, like, they're obviously observing what's going on in hip hop in the early 1990s, and this jazz turn, right? I mean, so whether you're thinking about, as you said, Guru, right? I mean, so Gangstar comes out with Jazz Thing, in the earlier in the decade, and they come out with a remix. So like there's that song. Guru begins to release his like collaborate with jazz artists, with Jazzmatazz, like his series. So folks like Donald Byrd, right? I mean, like folks that, again, I wouldn't come to really appreciate until the last sort of 15 years, right? I mean, so like Guru's collaborating, with these folks. And then you get the Far Side's first album, Bizarre Ride to a Far Side, which is also sampling a lot of jazz as well. And that's an album that Dave points to, that they were listening to a lot as they were recording Balloon Mind State. Then of course you have A Tribe Called Questlove and Theory, right? And them bringing in Ron Carter and A Tribe Called Quest, in some ways compared to Jazzmatazz, The Far Side, maybe a little less so with Diggable Planets, right? Like they really sort of popularize, incorporating jazz into rap music. And again, there's nothing like, I mean, there's no shortage of superlatives I can say about Low End Theory, right? I mean, like that's one of my all-time favorites as well.
Definitely.
And so yeah, they're incorporating live instrument, Tribe Called Quest incorporating live instrumentation as well. And then of course, yes, Diggable Planets, especially with Rebirth of Slick, right? I mean, also sort of launches jazz rap into the mainstream. They even win a Grammy, beating Snoop Dogg, right? I mean, like for that song, right? I mean, so De La Soul is entering into this moment, and admittedly, they're entering into it a little late, right? I mean, so like by the time Balloon Mind State comes out a few months later, you get enter the Wu-Tang 36 Chambers, Midnight Marauders, and Doggy Style, right? I mean, so De La Soul is sort of coming into this a little late, and yeah, they're bringing in live instrumentation. It's the first album of theirs where, they have skits on all their albums, and they popularize, skits, but they have just a song with Maceo Parker, blowing, right? I'd be blowing. And it's like, I'm a teenager, and I was like, oh, I didn't know I was into jazz, at least in this context, right? I mean, so like, and that song sets us up for IMIB, right? Which is, I think, one of De La Soul's, best songs, one of hip hop's best introspective songs, especially with Pasinous's, I think, sort of just classic first verse where he's rapping about, basically having a daughter. He's rapping about some of the internal tensions within native tongues. So just like basically giving us an insight into, how he's feeling emotionally. And I feel like, bringing in jazz, but then also I feel like this album is a lot more emotional, than their first two albums, whether it is IMIB, whether it is them critiquing, cultural appropriation on Patty Duke, sort of trying to figure out what it meant to be famous and what it meant for that fame to sort of, be to sort of slip away on songs like In Focus, but then also Break of Dawn, which is them sort of again another single that they didn't Dave at least didn't necessarily like, but they are also sort of trying, they're reminding the listeners of why they are legends at this point. And then of course Ego Trip in part two. I mean, so where
Amazing.
they are, yeah, exactly, where they are sort of adapting in sort of piecing, like they're piecing together other artists' lyrics and sort of remixing them in their own way as a critique of gangster rap that's coming, right? That that is coming, through the song. They're critiquing through the song and also through the video as well. So yeah, that album, it is, it's a fun album. It feels like jazz in a sense of if you haven't listened to it for the first, like when you listen to it for the first time, you just don't know where it's going, right? Like you from song to song, you don't know what's coming, and but then also, yeah, you get this, you get this instrumental break in the middle that I think is a masterpiece.
Let's listen to 20 seconds of Maceo Parker, I Be Blowin'. So one of the things I found really interesting about the section in your book about Maceo Parker, about Fred Wesley, was the fact that they had their own grievances with the way hip hop had used their music. And there's something about De La Soul inviting them in to do it the way they would want to do it that I frankly found very moving. Can you speak a little bit about that? Like what were some of the issues that these incredible, groundbreaking funketeers and jazz artists had with hip hop and hip hop sampling, and how did De La Soul really transcend that and listen to that?
No, Maceo Parker talks about this in his autobiography, and he critiques hip hop artists or rap artists who and producers who basically would just sample their music in a way that made that alienated Parker, right? In the sense of, Parker tells a story about, how he would, go in the studios, like he would, like artists would ask him to, play a riff or a section, and then basically from there, right, this artist would just take, take this riff or section and sort of manipulate it in a way without Parker knowing, right? I mean, so Parker, talks about how he had the most respect for De La Soul because De La Soul, not only asked him to sort of play on their album, but did so as almost part of a band, right? I mean, so like it was more or less about them sort of playing for De La Soul and recording in real time, as opposed to just sort of going in, recording some riffs, leaving, and then the riffs just sort of appearing on a song that basically Maceo Parker didn't have any clue was going to turn out or what it would sound like. And I think this is the distinction between folks like De La Soul bringing in Parker and Wesley, Tribe Called Quest bringing in Ron Carter, Guru collaborating with, by the end of the by the early 2000s, scores of jazz artists, right? I mean, like these artists, these rap artists were trying to collaborate with them, play with them, as opposed to just come in, play some riffs, and then I can take these riffs, I can sample them however I want, and then they may just not even be identifiable to the artist who played the riffs, right? I mean, so one could, like when reading about that, yeah, I could definitely feel how Maceo Parker felt disembodied, from some of the music that might have sampled him, and also, felt alienated in sort of a sort of, classical labor critique, right? Where it's just like, you're basically separating the artists, from their work, so much, to where, again, they cannot even sort of, they may not even notice that they're even on a song, right? And then of course, the question of we may not even get paid for it either, right? Whereas like De La Soul, A Tribe Called Quest, Guru, to my knowledge, were able to obviously, give these artists, their proper credit so then they could get paid.
The next one in the Holy Quartet of De La albums, Stakes is High. I'm hoping you could break that down a little bit because I view it as a very distinct record from what's come before. It's an effort of them by them to level a critique at hip hop, at society, while also making clear that this is a critical album for them and their careers to go forward. And yet they're also able to do all this without being preachy. I mean, it's a great hip hop album. What is your reaction? What's your analysis of Stakes is High and what makes it so essential, especially because I sometimes do feel like it gets forgotten when people look at the canon.
One of my favorite De La Soul records, and I will never forget watching the video on Rap City for the first time, and just Maury Povich, there's Maceo, Maceo, Posthumus, and True Glory just sitting in chairs, and I'm just thinking like, what's about to
What's
happen?
happening?
Because what is about to happen? Like Maury Povich is on, I'm just like, okay, this is different. And of course, like by then it had been 3 years, so there was a part of me that was like, oh, De La Soul is coming back, right? I mean, because it had been a few years, right? I mean, instead of, like the sort of 2 year intervals of their first three albums, right? I mean, so I was thinking, okay, and then yeah, the Dilla beat drops and they just start rapping. And, of course, like you get Dave, who is, sick of this, sick of that, sick of this, all, talking about what's happening in rap at the time. And I was like, whoa, okay, like, because yeah, like we're sort of approaching the height of the sort of quote unquote East Coast rap, West Coast sort of rivalry, which is really Bad Boy, Death Row, the sort of the rivalry between Tupac Shakur and Notorious B.I.G. And yeah, Biggie had released Ready to Die a couple years before, which in some ways began, also helped sort of shift hip hop sort of away from De La Soul, Native Tongues, Gangstar, these groups on the East Coast towards a more sort of gangster centric rap music that was preoccupied, with conspicuous displays of wealth, more basically more shiny beats, right? I mean, like by folks like Sean Combs, right? I mean, so rap is sort of moving in a different direction. Tupac drops All Eyes on Me, that January in 1996. And then the same, in within that first half, right? I mean, you get Tupac and then Fuji sort of response to all of this with the score. But then yeah, Jay-Z's Reasonable Doubt comes out. And Nas as It Was Written, comes out on July 2nd, the same day as Stakes is High, right? I mean, so like there's so much more I forgot, in terms of who else came out between January and the beginning of July, right? I mean, so De La Soul is responding to all these changes in rap music, especially as it's relating to this sort of surge of gangster rap, both on East and the West Coast, and sort of preoccupations with pursuing wealth and of course violence and the sort of fixation that artists like Tupac and Biggie had on death and violence as well, right? I mean, so yeah, when you listen to Stakes is High and you think about it in that context, you're just like, to me, the what became sort of known in the moment was, oh, like they are sort of warning us about something that could happen. So like they were sort of CNN, rap music CNN in a very different way in the mid-90s, right? So of course, Stakes is High addresses issues related to racism, right? Which is, sort of what Chuck D was talking about in the 80s. But De La Soul was reporting and editorializing about what they saw around them and what they noticed. And yeah, for them, Posthumus says this album is our Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, right? And which is a high bar. It's a very high bar, talking about departure album, departure music, with Marvin Gaye,
Great call. Great call.
You know, it's like that's a high bar to set. And yeah, you listen to the intro where they are, we are sort of reestablishing ourselves as high-level lyricists, on the intro, super MCs. They're critiquing the rap industry on the business, with Common. And then yeah, there are these, they sprinkle much of the album with these, references to like Biggie and Ready to Die, with sort of addressing gangster rap, addressing the violence, addressing, pursuit of wealth, and then sort of addressing sort of where hip hop is going in terms of, how women are presenting themselves, right? I mean, so like, they're addressing a lot, and they're keeping it De La, right? I mean, so like, these songs, like you said, they're not really preachy. They do call out some names, even though, like when it, especially on the introduction, when they talk about Naughty by Nature and Big Daddy Kane, who they said they weren't dissing, but Big Daddy Kane and Tretch took it as a diss. But they also call out the album Ready to Die, right? I mean, Dave, mentions it. But in the De La way, it's like you watch the video, it's so easy, right? Where Dave, it like that song is critiquing, sort of, some of these rappers' adoption of mafioso imagery and culture, mostly pulled from movies, right? I mean, so like King of New York and Scarface, of course, but he's calling that out. But in the video, it is like they're all in a cafeteria, them, other artists, Native Tongues, Lords of the Underground, they're all in this video, and it ends up with a food fight, right? I mean, so it's like this juxtaposition between a very serious message about, rap, gangster rap, the lack of love that Dave talks about, this pursuit of wealth, but then also, yeah, you're also watching them sort of throw food at each other.
Wow. First of all, what I'm about to say, we're gonna edit out. Are you okay with time? Okay, that this will be edited out. I say that because if it was part of it, you might feel pressure to be like, no, I'm great. So, but just making sure, off air, you're good. One of the parts of the book that's you name drop people like people may have forgotten, like Reverend Calvin Butts. People may not remember Cornel West's critique of gangster rap, which I think since then he's had a more nuanced view, but certainly went with Race Matters, he was hardcore. People like C. DeLores Tucker. What distinguishes Stakes Is High in your mind and their critique with the kind of moralistic critique? Remember Calvin Butts, I mean, he once, I remember this growing up in New York, like the bulldozer over the rap records. Like what distinguishes the two? Because there's a critique and then there's a kind of moralism coming that tries to sort of paint all of hip hop as this negative cultural force. How do you distinguish Stakes Is High from the Calvin Butts perspective?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And I think when thinking about folks like Calvin Butts, C. DeLores Tucker, Cornel West, to a degree, even bell hooks, some of these critiques, one, it's like you said, right? I mean, like it is sort of painting rap music with a broad brush, as if so, like in some ways, this critique in many ways reinforces some of the negative stereotypes about rap because you're not even mentioning De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest, Far Side, Queen Latifah, right? I mean, like you're actually not mentioning the artists that are leveling their own critiques of rap, right? But then also, you have, like when I teach my hip hop history class and I talk about, the sort of emergence of this, debate, I actually start with Biggie's Ready to Die, because that album comes out the same day Bill Clinton signed the crime bill, right? So like that album comes out the same day, they signed the crime bill. And if you listen to, Things Unchanged, the first song on Ready to Die, this is Biggie talking about all this violence that's going on around him that, in some ways lays this sort of, lays the context down for a lot of folks living in these neighborhoods wanting more policing, right? I mean, so like, of course, like there's this sort of complicated, legacy when it comes to some of this history around policing and race, especially in New York City, right? I mean, so like, you even have artists who are being critiqued who are well aware of the structural problems that are taking place that ensnared them into this sort of environment, right? I mean, so like, I always sort like starting with that because it explains to students that the artists that you may not assume had these critiques, at least implicitly did. Now, with De La Soul, I think on the one hand, right, for them, they understand the nuances of, rap music and hip hop culture and many of these rappers operating in this environment, right? I mean, so they're not even saying like we are still like totally anti-violent, They understand, right? I mean, when Pasta News talks about, what gun control means, means, holding a gun with two hands, like that's him acknowledging, right, some of these complications, in the ways in which young Black folks, especially young Black men, were operating, sort of in these, environments that were dominated by the drug economy, increased policing, racist policing, violent policing, et cetera, right? I mean, so they acknowledge some of these nuances that Butts, Hooks, West, C. DeLores Tucker did not really acknowledge, maybe until later, but then of course you take someone like C. DeLores Tucker and her critique of misogyny within rap, you're like, yeah, like it's hard to argue against that, right? I mean, it's like we hear it, we hear it. But then again, it's right, what are other artists saying and thinking about rap music as a conversation, like jazz, right? Think about rap music as a conversation among Black youth as opposed to this sort of, pathological, this product of pathology. And sort of, quote unquote, the cultural poverty. It's like, no, they're responding to structural forces and they're well aware of, the power that operates, within, whether it is capitalism and obviously police, right? I mean, so like these artists, they know this, right? I mean, so I think De La Soul, coming from the inside, being able to acknowledge the nuances while also critiquing, and warning against what they saw coming, I think is what distinguishes them from, some of these Black activists and scholars at the time.
So Stakes Is High comes out in 1996. I want to start to wrap up. You've been so generous with your time. And Dave Joliker dies so tragically right when the music is finally out on streaming. What he died in was it 24 that he died?
23. It was
23,
23.
23. Yeah, right
'Cause
when the
same
music.
year. Yeah.
Yeah, just utter tragedy. What is De La up to though between 1996 and 2023? What that's a long stretch for people who are
Yeah,
such
definitely.
active artists. Like where are their lives during that time?
Yeah, I mean, so what comes next after Stakes Is High is artificial intelligence, Mosaic Thump and Bionics, right? Where this series was originally planned as a triple album, in sort of response to all the double albums that are coming out in rap, whether it's Tupac, All Eyes on Me, Wu-Tang Forever, Master P puts out a double album. So does Bone Thugs and Harmony, of course, Life After Death, Biggie's album, right? So like they sort of thought that, oh no, well, this is what other folks are doing. We're just gonna one up everybody. And then Tom Silverman was like, how about you just put them out as individual records? Right? I mean, and these albums are, they put out two, and these albums are sort of return to form in terms of De La Soul, putting out, commenting on some serious things, but really, settling in on, sort of party music, having fun, collaborating with a lot of different artists, especially on Mosaic Thump. They collaborate with the Beastie Boys, the Alcoholics, Slick Rick, right? I mean, so like they're embracing, some of the older generation and some of the newer generation of rappers, on this. And then Bionics, comes out in late 2001, a few, basically a 3 months after the after 9/11. And Dave, presents this very personal, verse on Trying People, one of, his best verses. And then from there, it's The Grind Date. And The Grind Date, comes out in the mid 2000s. And it is, very much a comment about them being working artists, right? I mean, so if you open up the insert, it's like a calendar, and it has like some of their events and plans on the calendar, and they're rapping about work, right? I mean, which is another, theme that comes through a lot of their music. And then amid all this, you have, PostaNoose collaborating with Talib Kweli and a bunch of other artists on Ruckus Records for the Hip Hop for Respect, album and song in tribute to Amadou Diallo, who was murdered by NYPD. And then you also have De La Soul collaborating with the Gorillaz on Feel Good Inc., which further launches De La Soul into the mainstream. De La Soul and the Gorillaz, they win a Grammy for that song as well, right? I mean, so like De La Soul is on the one hand continuing to sort of rap about, their daily lives, as working rappers, but then also having another foot in the mainstream. And then yeah, we get into the 2010s, where PostaNoose and Dave, they released this album. I don't talk as much about it in the book, just sort of trying to like wrap things up. They do this First Serve album, which is another concept album. And then this sort of is in lead up to and the Anonymous Nobody and their campaign to get their music to gain control or regain control over their music, as the streaming economy is, taking shape and maturing, right? I mean, so the last, basically the last 10 years of their career, sort of starting from now, going back to like 2014, 2015, is consumed with them trying to regain control over their music from first Warner Brothers and then Tommy Boy.
One more question for you. Well, that's actually not true, but one more question for you and then a wrap-up question. This is something I asked you when you were here. I think it's a worthwhile question for my audience. We've seen in hip hop all-time groups, and I'm thinking of people like the Beastie Boys, I'm thinking about Tribe Called Quest, where a critical member, MCA, Fife Dawg, they pass away tragically, and the response of the group is, "We're done." Dave Jolicoeur, aka True Goy the Dove, he passes away, and the group has kept pushing on. Based on your decades-long analysis of this group, does that decision surprise you that they told that, and what does it say about them that they chose to press on?
When I first learned of Jolicoeur's passing, obviously devastated. And I wondered, okay, so what happens now? Because I'd been following their fight to get, to regain control over their music. And that was just that even made it more painful,
Oof.
just thinking, just like wow, like they were like a month away basically from releasing like re-releasing their music on streaming and being able to celebrate the legacy, and Dave is gone, right? I mean, just unimaginable, right? And then of course this is also happening in the sort of recognized 50th anniversary of hip hop culture, being sort of established. So all this is happening, and then Dave passes. And yeah, like Beastie Boys, right? Like you said, they decide that they're done. Run DMC, after Jam Master Jay is murdered, they decide they're done. Gangstar, right? I mean, like it's kind of hard to have Gangstar, when you're a duo and one member is the rapper who, and Guru's the one who passed away. So yeah, it was just like, so I wondered, okay, what's gonna happen? And then I think as I was, as I began to sort of write this book more and was doing and paying more attention, I saw a story where, PostaNoose and Mace said that actually they're not going to stop. One, they're going to keep performing, which is different, than the other groups. And then two, there might be more new music, which I was also, I was like, okay, but for me, after thinking about it, it just made sense. Because on the one hand, they're artists, right? I mean, like, I don't know what else, it's hard to imagine what PostaNoose and Maceo would do, other than, it doesn't mean that they couldn't go, go into acting. It doesn't mean that they might not have investments somewhere or work on other endeavors. But we De La Soul has been a constant because of the recorded music and just them becoming an amazing group, like performing group, right, on tour and in concerts, right? I mean, so like they are masters at what they do. So I think when you're an artist, you're constantly looking, you're constantly open to creativity, and you're constantly looking for ways to create, so I think them being artists and rappers is what sort of keeps them going. And then of course, Posse Noose and Macy will talk about how Dave's sister told them, "You better not stop." Excuse me, because if you stop, then Dave stops. Right? I mean, so like, them keeping going is a testament to Dave as well. And if you listen to Cabin in the Sky, which is a beautiful album, Dave is
Love
on
it.
there. But yeah, you also feel his absence. Like it's one of those albums where you feel his absence and his presence at the same time. Whether it's the roll call at the beginning, or even the last song, right? I mean, in the song sort of ending with Dave's voice echoing, right? As it feels like you're getting distant, further away from him and his spirit, right? I mean, so yeah, like it's hard to imagine Beastie Boys. I think they could do it, but the way that they rhyme in this sort of three-man weave, you need that third person, right? I mean, like that's how they deliver their out, like that's how they deliver their lyrics. Gangstar, again, you need a rapper, right? And you need Guru, you need his voice. Tribe Called Quest, their last album, was great. And just the feeling of hearing Jarobi, spit once again, right? It's like, this is amazing. But then, yeah, like if they were trying to do something else after, how do you do that without Fife, right? I mean, so De La Soul, to me, between their artistry, them wanting to continue, Dave's legacy and their own legacy, and them always being creative people, I think is what sort of is going to allow them to sort of continue to put out more music and be productive if they want to be.
Last question, and you've been so generous with your
Yeah,
time.
of course.
I really
Of
appreciate
course.
it.
Yeah, of course.
Because it's a question I ask everybody when I interview them, but it's interesting to ask you this question. I'm wondering if you're
Yeah.
going to swerve on me, but I always ask people who've written books, what was their soundtrack, either while they were writing the book, like what music they would have in the background, or maybe what they listened to decompress. Between writing, musical inspiration, playlists, whatever. Now,
Yeah.
the easy answer probably is you were listening to a lot of De La Soul while writing
Very
this,
true.
but
Very
I was
true.
wondering maybe what else was entering your transom as you tried to put words to paper.
Yeah, no, great question. Yeah, De La Soul. But then I listened to a lot of early 90s rap, like just generally, right? I mean, so, Leaders of the New School, especially the Time album, right? I mean, which is an album that I kind of overlooked. And then,
Everybody did.
And then sort of started listening to What's Next. And that was a song that I was like, oh, repeat, 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 repeat. I mean, so like, love that album. Far Side's, Bizarre Ride to a Far Side, listen to that a lot as well. Some of the, I listened to a lot of Souls of Mischief, right? I mean, so like, yeah, just a lot, That's How You Lost, right? I mean, like, so a lot of that. I think, some De La Soul songs that I fell in love with that I didn't realize I was in love with. Trouble in the Water, their song that appears on one of the DJ Honda albums, one of my favorite De La Soul songs, very nostalgic. And this song is like late 90s, right? I mean, like, so, and they're rapping about their childhood, so you're just like, they're not even, I don't even think they're even, they might have been 30, maybe, right? I mean, so like another amazing song. And then listen to a lot of jazz. Listen to a lot of jazz. A lot of Donald Byrd, right? I mean, so like I, especially his fusion phase, like I was like, I'm just gonna listen to all of this, and yeah, fell in love with all of that. Who else? Joe Henderson, especially Power to the People. Love that album. I'm trying to remember some other artists, but no, it was a lot of 1970s jazz, which I'm a novice jazz listener, right? I mean, so like I know that that's not the decade that people point to as the golden age of jazz, and I definitely respect that. But no, I mean, it's like just listening to songs that a lot of De La Soul or a Tribe Called Quest, all these other artists were sampling at the time, right? I mean, and it was just like there's a whole new world, and I think that's the thing coming out of writing this book that it reminded me about my love for music in general, which is like there's just always something to learn, right? And there's always something sort of new to me in a sense, especially since we have access to a lot of music, even though I I don't really listen to Spot, I don't use Spotify, but like the other, it's yeah, like there's just more out there, and it's fun to go back to and listen to a bunch of older stuff. But yeah, a lot of early 90s hip hop, which I'm still doing now, and a lot of 1970s jazz.
Incredible. The book is Living in a Daisy Age, the Music, Culture, and World that De La Soul made. The author is Austin McCoy. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Nation Magazine podcast.
And no, thank you, Dave. This was great. Very much a pleasure.
Man, it was a pleasure for me. It was a pleasure for me to read the book, which I recommend highly to everybody. And it was a pleasure to actually speak to the author about it. A pleasure and a privilege. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
We'll be back after a quick word from the sponsor of Edge of Sports, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this, but first, a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. Okay, look, the need for independent journalism has never been more important, and The Nation brings it each and every week like they've been doing since 1865. I'm serious. This is what you gotta read. It's The Nation Magazine. Go to thenation.com/subscribe. And please never forget that when you support The Nation Magazine, you are also supporting the continued existence of this podcast. So please subscribe. Go to www.thenation.com/subscribe. And now back to the Edge of Sports podcast. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you so much to Austin McCoy for joining us once more. The book is called Living in a Daisy Age, The Music, Culture, and World De La Soul Made. Thank you so much to The Nation Magazine. Thank you so, so much to my producer, David Tigabu. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. I'm Dave Zirin. We are out of here. Peace.